Good morning. Oh, I hate to interrupt what sounds like really yummy conversation, but you can resume it later. Bonjour, bienvenue à toutes et tous. Welcome to this big thinking lecture hosted by the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. I am Noreen Golfman. I'm chair of the board of the, and I'm president, I should say. I forget which hat I'm wearing this morning. President of the Federation's Board of Directors, and it's, of course, very good to be back on a very sunny day on Parliament Hill. I flew in very late from very foggy St. John's last night and had to go through very rainy and miserable Toronto, and so being here in sunny Ottawa is quite a pleasure at this hour. Always, yes, sure, whatever you say. We're ready, of course, this morning on this bright sunny day for another wonderful, engaging presentation by our speaker. I would like especially to extend a very warm welcome to all of the members of Parliament and senators who've joined us here today. Thank you all for coming. As you know, those of you who have been attending regularly, the goal of the Big Thinking Lecture here is to connect research with those who are using it on a daily basis. This current and relevant research assists you as policymakers and as legislators in forming your work and helping you formulate sound public policy. La recherche en sciences humaines est essentielle pour relever les grands défis de notre époque. Les chercheurs de notre collectivité aident à faire avancer le savoir nécessaire pour prendre des décisions éclairées et au bénéfice des Canadiens et Canadiennes. Of course, their research is essential to inform debate, fuel innovation in every sector, and improve the lives of all Canadians. We are very pleased to have an example of excellence in social science and humanities research with us here today. Widely recognized for his so-called out-of-the-box thinking on pension governance, finance, and investment issues, Keith Ambachir is the president and founder of KPA Advisory Services. He has been an extremely prominent figure in the pensions investments industry since 1969. He's published very widely on this topic. He has received numerous awards for all of his significant work. In 2005, he was appointed director of the Rotman International Center for Pension Management and adjunct professor of finance at the Rotman School of Management, University of Toronto. So the drill is, as you know, those of you who have been here, Mr. Ambachir will speak for approximately 20 minutes, followed by as much time as questions and discussion will allow. We are directed this morning to be really quitting this room, this lovely room, by 8:45 sharp. So we'll try and keep everybody on time. So for now, please join me in welcoming our distinguished speaker, Keith Ambachir.
Thank you, Noreen, and Pierre, merci beaucoup for all your work you did in arranging this. Pierre was very clear in terms of his instructions. I have to offer you some big thinking on the question of pension reform, and I have to do it in such a way that the impact of the social sciences and social scientists is very clear in terms of how the thoughts that I will share with you. My plan has three parts. I'll start out very briefly with how I became a social scientist. I thought that was worth at least a couple of minutes. Then I'll talk briefly about three really big thinkers, giants, if you like, that have impacted me in terms of framing these kinds of issues. And then we'll turn to the question of pension reform and where Canada is today, in my view, and what our challenges are and how we can actually meet them successfully. So that's the plan. For most of us, I think where we end up is at least partially accidental, and that's certainly true in my case. I was finishing Sarnia Collegiate Institute Technical School in late 1960s. In a situation where the family of my father died, the family didn't have money, and the only place that would pay you to go to school at university was the regular officer training program. So I ended up going to Royal Roads. Now, the shock about Royal Roads was that, at that time, at least the military tried to make you all regular scientists, not social scientists, and engineers. So the first year program was, it was two chemistries, two physics, two maths, engineering drawing, which was I was terrible at, and then also English, French, and military history. And if you got through that first year, then there was, you could change to arts in the second year. But you had to do this the first year. And so I think about, this is Royal Roads, about 130 of us went in. 70 of us survived the first year. And then 9 of us chose to go into arts. So we were a very small, elite group of arts men at that time, going into things like economics and some of the other social sciences. Then we moved on together and joined our brothers from Royal Military College and Collège Militaire Royal, and then the two final years, actually, you could really focus. We had some very good economics professors at RMC at that time. So that's how I got into this space. Economics was always fascinating to me. I spent some time at Western and McGill, and then suddenly realized at some point with economics, you just start making it up. There's only so much time that you can spend in academia. So I ended up at my first private sector job was at Sun Life, and it was in the investment department. And my job at that time was fascinating because some new investment theories had just started to get conveyed, Harry Markowitz, Bill Sharpe. And my job was to go, Nobel Prizes, by the way, 20 years later. And my job was to go meet these people, figure out what they were talking about, at the same time learn what a real investment department did, and to see whether there was any connection between the two. And so I've been doing that kind of work ever since, is to try and figure out what the good theories are, what the real-world problems are, and how you can actually build the connections. On the way through, what happened was, well, one of the interesting things about Sun Life also is that the net new cash flow coming into the business in the 1970s was pension money. And so that was interesting to me, was where's this money coming from? What purposes does it serve, and how should it be managed, was the broad question. And that was a bigger question than just the micro-application of investment theory. And there were three giant thinkers that helped me kind of sort things out and straighten me out in terms of how I would evolve into the 80s and the 90s into this first decade of this century. John Maynard Keynes, anybody who's taken economics recognizes Keynes as the father of modern economics. He's done many things. It's chapter 12. I still have the general theory that I got in 1961. It still sits on my shelf. And the great chapter is chapter 12. It's got long-term expectations, and it's the best essay ever written on investments. And the essence of it is that there's two kinds of investing. There's trading pieces of paper with each other, which he called beauty contest investing. And then there's real investing, where you turn savings into private capital and wealth. And he thought we should do the latter rather than the former. And that stuck with me as a really important idea. The second is, anybody who's taken economics has used probably Paul Samuelson, the text, Samuelson Economics. The first one is 1947, and it just kept redone and redone and redone. So Samuelson is the teacher of modern economics. But he was also a very creative thinker, and a really important piece that he contributed to all of us was, if you like, the life cycle model of personal finance. And the idea is, it's very simple but very powerful, which is that we as individuals have our personal lives. We also have our financial lives, and there's three phases: pre-work, work, and post-work. And the idea is, pre-work, you build your intellectual capital, you use that capital during your work experience, and during that work experience, you consume, and you also save, because there's a third phase called the post-work phase, where you have to live on some income when you're not working. And so he raised all the really critical questions around, well, how long are you going to work? How long are you going to live after you stop working? What's the investment return going to be on your savings while you're saving, while you're working? how long, the kind of risks that come into this equation in terms of, for example, longevity risk. On average, we live 20 years after we retire, on average. But not everybody lives 20 years. The actual distribution is between 1 and 30 or 40. And so you have this longevity risk as to, well, which one of these people are you going to be? Tomorrow or 40 years from now? So you have, there are all kinds of interesting questions that Shambleson raises with this theory, which are now the key elements of how we design retirement systems. And then the third great thinker that impacted me is Peter Drucker. Now, Peter Drucker is not a conventional academic-type economist, but he is recognized by many as the father of modern management theory. And Peter's contribution is to say, well, you know, whatever we get done collectively, you need organizations to do it. And organizations can be effective or ineffective. And how they're managed and how they're governed is tremendously important to the success of society. And he wrote one book out of the many books that he wrote on pensions. And he wrote it in 1976. It's called The Unseen Revolution, How Pension Fund Socialism Came to America. And so this is now 1976. He's looking at the demographics, and he's saying, you know, when this baby boom generation, which in the 70s was still very young, when they go through the 80s and the 90s, it's going to generate a giant wave of retirement savings, which is going to raise some very interesting questions around things like, in whose interest will this giant pool of retirement savings be managed? And there are lots of people and lots of groups that will have their eye on that money. Governments will. The business community will. Organized labor will. And the financial services industry will, because that will be a source, tremendous source of fees somewhere down the road. And his challenge to us, and this is now somebody writing in 1976, was how do we make sure that that giant pool of assets will be managed in the best interest of the beneficiaries rather than in the interest of all possible other power groups? And that's an organizational structure question. It has to do with legal structures. It has to do with creating institutions that are focused on getting the right outcomes for that pool of retirement savings. So that's what those were my framework that I went into the 80s with, and then I got into the broad, what you might call the political economy of pensions, looking at it in a very broad sense, but also looking at it at a micro sense at the individual organizational level of how do you create organizations that can actually deliver the goods at a reasonable price. Now we get to the third part of the discussion, which is, okay, where is Canada today with this broad question of the pension debate that we've been having? And it's worth noting here that we actually went through the 1990s and very successfully updated and stabilized the Canada and Quebec pension plans. And that we did that by global standards. It's recognized internationally that we actually identified a problem, figured out a solution, got enough consensus to actually push that solution through. And basically what it involved was to move up the contribution rate relatively quickly from about 5% of pay to 10, create a very large reserve fund, create an institution called the CPP Investment Board, and in fact manage that reserve fund so that we could stabilize the contribution rate. Elegant solution, and we've actually implemented. And 10 years later, it still looks like a very good solution. Where are we now? Well, we seem to have something like a 15-year reform cycle in pensions in Canada. So it takes a long time for these issues to be identified. And it alternates back and forth between public pensions and private pensions. So we did public pensions in the 1990s. You add 15 years, and here we are today. And we really haven't looked at the private side, the whole employment-based pension plans, RRSPs, for a long time. In any systematic way, and we're now due, so that's why we're doing what we're doing. We have identified, I think, the problems and the challenges reasonably well. We all know about the demographics, right? I mean, those are hardwired into the reality. We also know that coverage in pension plans, registered pension plans, is declining over time, especially in the private sector. So having fewer and fewer workers actually members of these pension plans. Today, the number is something like only 25% of the private sector workforce is a member of a registered pension plan, for example. We know we've got some sustainability issues. Anybody that's here, especially I think in this hall, knows about the Nortel story and what can happen in the private sector if a pension plan is underfunded and the company goes out of business. So we know about that kind of issue. What's been happening on the way through then is, if you like, the individualization of pension accounts, less collectivity, more individual approaches. We know about that. An issue that some of us have been trying to put in the forefront that's tremendously important that hasn't got the amount of attention that I believe it deserves, which is the cost of intermediation. How much money does it cost to turn a dollar's worth of retirement savings into ultimately a dollar's worth of pension over here? And the rule of thumb that you should, if you remember anything, there's a rule of thumb for you that if you increase the cost of the pension management by 1% per year in relation to the assets, ultimately you end up with 20% lower pensions down the road. Now, I'll also tell you that we have basically two sectors in Canada, a wholesale sector, which runs at relatively low cost. So these are the CPP-QPP assets, the employment-based pension plan assets. $1.1 trillion runs at relatively low cost. But we also have $700 billion of what we might call retail retirement savings that is invested in retail mutual funds, for example. The fees on some of those funds runs well over 2%, as you all should know. The difference between, let's say, 0.5% and 2.5%, a 2% differential in costs. So if you use my simple rule of thumb, that's going to produce a lot less pension if you're in the high-cost stream in relation to the low-cost stream. It's a major issue that we need to look at, we need to address, and, of course, you know, it's not in everybody's interest to put that forward, because there is a very large cash flow going to the financial services industry right now that represents that 2% differential. But there it is. It's very real, and I believe we need to deal with it. So where are we on the solutions front to these questions? Well, we've come a long way, and this is, I think, where the research that we've been doing, the debates that we've been having have been very, very useful. The one thing that everybody agrees on is that our rules and regulations in relation to pensions are 30 years out of date, and that's a long time to be out of date, and we need to update them. There are a whole lot of things that we need to do in order to facilitate the management and structure of pension arrangements for the 21st century. They relate to multi-employer plans. We need to be able to create collective entities that we currently can. The Income Tax Act is out of date. It needs to be updated in a number of different ways. So there is this housekeeping element that we all agree that we need to do. The reason it's difficult in Canada is because some of it is federal, a lot of it is provincial, and you've got this interaction collaboration challenge that I'm hoping that because we've been working at this now that we can get on with. It won't directly solve, if we do the rules and regulations fix, it won't solve the coverage problem by itself. It won't magically get a whole lot of private sector workers that don't have a pension plan. What do we do about that? And there are now three solutions have surfaced. One is the private sector solution, which is let the market work and we'll take care of things, which is basically fixing all these old rules. If we have the right rules, the industry argues we can do the rest. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the Canadian Labour Congress and the CARP group and other groups that say, well, you know, we have a perfectly good CPP-QPP set of arrangements, and all we need to do is just change the dials, because right now it's a very modest system. It only replaces 25% of income up to the median wage, which is about $47,000. Well, if you double the eligibility, the YMPE, from, let's say, 47 to 94, well, then you're covering a lot more income. And the other thing is that you don't need to set the dial at 25% replacement. You can move it to 50% replacement, for example. So the argument there is that we already have these mechanisms. Let's change the dials, and let's have a low-cost collective system that works for everybody. The downside, of course, is that it assumes that one size fits all. And so those are the two extremes. Not so extreme, really. It's not the right word. Those are the two ends of the spectrum. And then in the middle, some of us are saying, well, let's try and find something that tries to do the best, have the best elements of both. I proposed something called CSPP, the Canada Supplementary Pension Plan, a couple of years ago in a C.D. Howe paper, which would envision creating a low-cost plan that would automatically enroll all workers in Canada that are not members of a pension plan into an arrangement out of which they could opt out if they wanted to, but that would at least get everybody playing in a collective pension arrangement with lots of flexibility. There's all kinds of details you could get into, but the idea, I think you understand, of something in between those two positions, and that's got traction as a reasonable possibility as to where we might go. The third issue, I'll come back to it just for another minute here, is this cost question. What do we do about the cost question? Well, it can relate actually to how we solve the coverage problem, because, for example, if we do the a significant CPP-QPP expansion, it's actually the operating costs of that system are relatively low. So that would solve the cost problem. My idea of a CSPP, again, would run at very large scale, would be well-governed, the same way that we govern the CPP Investment Board. So, again, it would run at relatively low cost. So there are – Australia is dealing with the same problem, and they have some interesting ideas. So I think there are ways that we can deal with the cost challenge as well. Now, Pierre, this is now the social sciences plug comes in here. The identification of these issues and the framing of them and the development of possible responses to them doesn't come out of thin air. We actually have had a very significant effort in Canada by a group of social scientists that range from economists – I made a list here somewhere – because there's different ways you can describe these different elements of social science, of course. Demography has played a huge role in this. The actuarial profession has played a huge role in this. The behavioralist, the psychologist, in terms of there's a whole new branch of finance called behavioral finance. And it recognizes the fact that even though it's very convenient in economic theory for everybody to be rational, because you can derive some very nice principles out of everybody being rational all the time, real people, like everybody in this room, doesn't follow those rules all the time. And so we have to develop social policies and social structures that recognize our imperfections as decision makers. And how you build those notions of real people behavior rather than theoretical behavior into the institutional structures that we create is one of the great challenges. And it's required both sort of a psychological view of observing human behavior together with the institutional knowledge that we've learned by looking at the functionality of different institutions, that you can actually weave some of these things together into designs that actually will get more people to where they want to go more cost-effectively over time. All of us in this field can take some credit for the debate, the very important debate that's already gone on, is going on, the research that has been done to where we are today. So now we stand in closing here. With one more question to answer, which is, where do we go from here? And, of course, most of you in this room know that the next minister's meeting is in the middle of June. And the question is, are we now at a stage where we can actually start to make some decisions? You know, where we can take all of this work that's been done, the debates that have gone, the solutions that have been proposed, Are we now in a position where the ministers can sit in the room and say, well, we should do this, this, and this? And my sense is we're not quite there yet. And I think what we need now is the kind of federal provincial task force that we that was actually created in the 1990s to take the work in relation to the public pensions challenges that we had at that time, and to say, how do we take all this research and some consensus about the general direction where we should go, how do we turn it into a concrete plan? And that was an impartial federal provincial task force that was given that task. I had a chance to advise on some issues, some elements of it over time. And out of that came a concrete proposal to say, you know, everything considered, this is what we should do. And that's where I think we need to go next now with all of this great work that we've already done, is that I think it needs more focus than we currently have. You have these different positions. I can visualize ways in which the best of some of these proposals can be put together into a package. But I think it's going to require some very focused work by an impartial group of people to actually put it together. So that's my personal sense now of where we are. It worked for us very well in the 1990s. We have a great public servants in this country, both federally and provincially. So I say, let's put the best of the, together in a group, give them a very clear mandate, and give them 6 months, not another study that takes another bunch of years, to take the existing things we've already done and to say, in the next 6 months, we want this group to come up with some very clear recommendations as to where Canada should go from here. And so we'll see whether it works that way or not. I do believe that is where we are and where we need to go. So I close with the leading the word. I think the original title of this talk was Pension Reform: How Canada Can Lead. Well, there's actually an index, a pension quality index, global pension quality index, that the Australians have invented and actually launched just last fall. Their original approach was 11 countries, and Canada is one of the 11, and we're number four. And what's interesting about the first three, which is the Netherlands, Australia, and Sweden, is that in their own ways, they all have the entire workforce, both public sector and private sector, into an organized pension arrangement. And we're number four because we haven't done that yet. And I think if we want to get up into the top three, that's what we need to figure out how to do. And so the mantra that we can develop out of this is, apropos our very successful Olympics that we had just this past February, is Canada can own the pension podium. We know what we need to do. We just now need to collectively figure out how we do it, ideally this year, in terms at least of having a clear direction of what we need, where we want to go forward from here. So thank you very much. That's the story. That's the pension story.
There's a microphone on the floor. Please feel free to queue up.
Good morning. My name is Ralph Sullivan. I'm a retiree, so I'm getting the benefits of having done most of the things right, and I very much appreciate your speech. I think it was on target, gives a sense of history, also gives us a sense of options. However, I do look at two other aspects, and it may be more social than a saving aspect, but one is the economics of all of these programs. Mm-hmm. There are people who cannot afford, in our current society, to put it into any kind of pension program. Mm-hmm. And then those at the other end, with so much money, that in a way they can work their own pension arrangements mm-hmm. out. And I'm wondering how, in a rescheduling, we're looking at this global issue, how do we encourage people to to want to be part of this program and to financially be able to do so.
Yep.
Because I think the social benefits of even the poorest of the poor, knowing that they're in a system as a responsible individual and going to receive those benefits the same as any other rich, middle, or poor person, has social value. And if we just don't say 20% will always be poor, they'll always have to get welfare, and they'll never really be contributing.
Yep.
If
yep.
we could somehow drag out of that morass of people under difficult circumstances, some link into the system, whether it's they're working at McDonald's or can't work because of other issues,
yep.
that they would see themselves as functioning parts of this money. Because this money's to build on, as if I take your position, it's not just to put in a bank and trade
right.
paper.
So we have actually thought about this over time, right? And you can argue with the specifics, but actually Canada's done it reasonably well, I think, by global standards. If you look at a system like, for example, France, they have one giant pay-go system for everybody. That's actually quite rich. Unfortunately, there's very little funding. It's a pay-go system. Right now, people are doing quite well, but the contribution rate to support that system keeps going up as a demographics change. It's not sustainable.
Okay.
And so one of the tests of how you design one of these systems is sustainability, recognizing changing demographics. And we've done a reasonably good job of that. Now, you know, the public's part of our system, for example, generates 100% income replacement at $20,000. So you can say, well, you know, $20,000 is not a lot to live on. It's true. But now, you know, where we set our income support level, whether it's for the unemployed or whether it's for retirees, is definitely something we should discuss nationally over time. And, you know, it's the tension between affordability and need. It's always there. The reality is that at low incomes, we do relatively well when you combine OAS, GIS, Guaranteed Income Supplement, and the CPP-QPP. So that's what we've done. And so a lot of what I was talking about here was basically to say, rightly or wrongly, that's what we've done with the public part of our system. It generates quite high income replacement rates at low income levels. But what we haven't done very well is to create mechanisms for middle-income workers, especially in the private sector, to systematically save enough in some systematic way to allow them to maintain a standard of living post-work. So that's sort of where we are today. And I think it's an ongoing debate as to whether, you know, whether we should do more at the low-income level. But that really right now is not the focus of where we are today. No, that was our discussion in the 1990s. And we'll have it again in the next decade. Okay?
Thank you.
Keith, I come from the practitioner side. I'm Barb Mayaska. I'm the Director of Pension Fund and Treasury with the University of Ottawa, and I'm also the Vice Chair of PIAAC. So as you know, PIAAC's been very involved in a lot of submissions. Lots of plan sponsors are involved in efforts to deal with legacy problems and make their plans sustainable for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two areas I'd like you to comment on. One of them is on the regulatory side. As you've mentioned, we have a lot of different regulatory jurisdictions.
Yep.
It creates a lot of complication. The rules are different for everybody. And it is also one of the deterrents in a very long list of deterrents to the private sector providing defined benefit pension plans. So in this big thinking and in this effort to, you know, fix the retirement system for the future, how do you see dealing with that and how important that is going to be to the success of those efforts? And my second area I'd like you to comment on, and that goes to the legacy issues. I think it's a different matter of looking at how we can fix things for the future and what is the right way to do it. The problem is we all have these legacy issues, and there's also a long list of reasons why they can't be easily fixed. So if you can just comment on if there's any way to bring those two together.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting about this global pension index, and I think the Australians have done us all a favor by creating this, created by social scientists, by the way, in Australia, this index, is that it allows us to get a sense of, well, why are numbers 1, 2, and 3, why are they there? And I observed that one of the reasons they're there is because these three countries have figured out of how to get everybody involved in some kind of an organized retirement income system. The other thing, just to pick up on your point that's interesting, is that while employers continue to be very interested in the system, they don't play as major a role in the Netherlands, in Sweden, and in Australia as they do still here, for example. And I think that makes sense. I think we should let employers do what they're really good at, you know, whether it's running a university and educating people or making widgets. And we should rethink the whole organizational structure around pensions in a more collective way. So, for example, Australia and the Netherlands, they've gone to large industry-type funds away from individual employers towards more collective arrangements. Sweden has done some very interesting things in terms of creating a national defined contribution system that adjusts over time. So there's a lot of creativity has gone into that. I think that we need to now step back in Canada and say, how do we become more effective, more efficient, and how do we redefine the role of employers to not be the primary provider of the pension plan, but to play a more supportive role in a more collective type arrangement. So I think that's where we need to take our thinking. Now, you know, the legacy question is, okay, if that's where you want to go, how do you get there? And the reality is in Canada that a lot of our traditional defined benefit plans are hardcore plans in the sense that those liabilities, you know, rank relatively high on the obligation scale of the sponsoring institution. Including on the public sector side, where, you know, they're effectively government debt. And what we've been doing historically is to undervalue that debt and understate its true economic value. Well, if something looks cheap, let's have more of it, right? And it's only when you start properly reporting the true cost. For example, public service pension plan today, at today's interest rates, costs over 30% of pay. Contribution rate going into it, I think, is about 18% of pay. It's a huge gap. And so part of what we need to do is to start fessing up to the cost of pensions. You know, if you run a pension plan where eligibility for retirement is at, you know, late 50s or something like that, and if you got a healthy 57-year-old going on retirement, you know, the expectation is 25, 30 years that you have to pay that pension. It's very expensive. And so I think we've been fooling ourselves. The reason that we've done that is that it looked so easy in the 1980s and the 1990s because we had these great capital market returns, and you could put in relatively low savings rates, and they would compound in the marketplace, and everybody'd be okay. And we projected that would continue forever. And guess what? It didn't happen in the last decade, and it's not likely to happen in the next decade. So let's get real. And then we have the question of, okay, this accumulated debt, what do you do with it? And what the Dutch did, and this is the Nederlandse Bank, the central bank in the Netherlands, which is a pension regulator as well, they basically did what I believe we need to do, where we need to go, which is to say that, you know, we have a perfectly sensible way in which we regulate banks and insurance companies if they create financial promises that they have to keep. They have to run a balance sheet that, unless it's perfectly matched, needs risk capital on that balance sheet. What do we do with pension plans? We allow them to be underfunded for years. And then when things get really bad, you get the corporations coming to the Hill here saying, you know, the solvency rules, we have to change them. We need more time. Well, is that really prudent? I mean, that's how Nortel got into its problems. So I think we need to go to a much more prudential regulatory regime for defined benefit plans. And some employers will say, well, we can't afford it then. And then I would say, right, so stop pretending. And then the final question is, what do you do with the accumulated debt? Well, you either figure out how to pay it off, or you declare insolvency and create more Nortels. There is no other way.
Last question. Yes, my name is Sean Murphy, Member of Parliament for Charlottetown. I enjoy your comments, and you're quite right that I think the time has come for Canada to have a major overall of its private sector pension plan. And we've developed, and you hit the point, that we've developed a very elaborate system of a high-cost retail pension plan, mm-hmm. which really isn't working. And at MERs of 2.5-3%, yep. it's a very, very ineffective way to deliver pensions to the masses. And yep. as the larger companies abandon any kind of a defined benefit plan, we're seeing more and more of that. There's high marketing. These resources would be much better deployed in other areas of the economy. But I do want to point out that in doing this, making these statements, you're taking on some pretty sacred cows here, the whole banking
oh,
industry.
Really?
The insurance industry. And,
I hadn't noticed.
And, well, I've noticed. And it's going to be a very, very difficult challenge. And by setting up this task force, I don't think that'll do it because what has to be done is there has to be a how it's done, I'm not totally sure, but the whole high-cost retail industry has yeah. to be restructured. You can't have people selling RSPs and charging 3% yeah. a year because it's not going to work, and everyone in this room knows that. So that's what has to be overcome, but there's going to be some major, major obstacles on that path because the banks and the insurance industry and all these individuals that are in the industry, probably in the hundreds of thousands, are going to fight this every step of the way.
Right.
And the last comment yeah. I would make is talking about the imperfections. I really think at the end of the day, I don't think we can avoid the plan being compulsory. I don't think not being opt-in will work, yeah. especially for people under 40.
Right. Well, I appreciate your comments. Our Australian friends are actually helping us out at this front. They went to choice of fund legislation in 2004, and effectively it was the Howard government at that time, and it was very much a free market type approach to say, you know, let's just give everybody choice and the market will figure it out. Well, some of us would say, yeah, right, you know, not in this area for some very specific reasons. 5 years later, they have now created a super review commission in Australia, which is about to report this final report, and it's all about, well, why didn't it work? Cost didn't go down. Funds didn't get more cost effective. People didn't make the choices. Everybody ends up in the default fund because they don't want to choose. And so now the Australians are saying, okay, that didn't work. Where do we go from here? And they're actually coming up with some very interesting ways of still using private sector delivery, but to create a structure which basically gets outside oversight in the default fund. So if you end up in the default fund, then there's an outside governance process with which the provider has to negotiate delivery and cost and standards. And I think that's a very interesting model in which we might be able to combine both, you know, the technical side of delivery with some kind of, see what's missing here, it's called a wonderful term for economics, it's informational asymmetry. You have a market here with informational asymmetry. The sellers know more about what they're sellers than the buyers know about what they're buying. And so you have to level the playing field. And the way you do that is you create this surrogate buying element that can negotiate on behalf of the members. And if we can insert that into our system, we just may be able to find a way to get enough collective cohesion around that kind of a solution where everybody plays. And that's what I would have this task force recommend if I had a chance to advise him.
Thank you.
I'm feeling a little bit more symmetrical after 45 minutes as a consumer potential and a client. Before formal thanking, I just want to make mention, special mention here of the presence of Chad Gaffield, who is As we know, our chef, president of the Social Science Humanities Research Council, SHRC, and welcome, Chad, always good to see you. And without SHRC's support, these breakfasts and this kind of big thinking would not be possible. So thank you very much. I want to now invite Marlon Jennings, who's here. She is the MP for Notre Dame de Grasse, to thank our speaker. Thanks to her and to Mike Savage, who's normally here. Those of you who are usually at these breakfasts will recall Mike's smiling face. I think he's doing something that's taking him away from this, but caucus. Oh, that's not minor. But thank you, Martin.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Ambekshir, for your very inspiring but troubling speech. I think that today you just showed why social sciences and humanities, in my view, and I think probably everybody seated here would agree, are in fact the disciplines of the third millennium, at least the first part of it. Innovation is great. Basic science research is wonderful. And we need humanities and social sciences because you help us figure out how to actually live our lives in a way that is healthy and is sustainable. I'd like to thank the Canadian Federation for Humanities and Social Sciences as well for hosting these breakfasts and all of the supporters that you have that allow you to do this. I think that government should be supporting our humanities and social sciences even more, should be supporting the scientific research that goes on even more. I think Keith Ambekshir has just shown why it's so important. So thank you again. This is a small token of appreciation from the Canadian Federation. I'm assuming it's a token. I didn't actually wrap it. So if you have to go through airport security, you might want to ask what it is before you get there. But thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Merlin, and I can assure you we did not script anything she said. That was so especially appreciated. Oh, Mike did, yeah. And we don't script Mike. I don't think you can script Mike. Thank you very much. Thank you to our distinguished speaker. I just want to make mention that information about our upcoming quite large, big thinking Congress, Annual Learners Congress, is available as you walk through the door. There are some brochures for you if you're interested. It's going to be a wonderful 8 days at Concordia University in Montreal at the end of May. And so if you're in Montreal, drop into Concordia. There should be 8,000 to 9,000 scholars there from our disciplines, thinking big and probably talking small gossip, but thinking really big ideas during their papers. Stay tuned for more information on more big thinking lectures from the Federation. Thank you all for coming. Invest wisely and prudently and collectively, I think, is the message. Merci, bonne journée.